Yep, Skype is open for you now, ready to roll along with all the other lines on Coast to Coast AM. This is your opportunity now to talk to a real scientist and anthropologist, Hank Wesselman, through the eyes of a shaman, awakening to the spirit world. You should have had some storable food with you, Hank. That works.
Well, you know, when we go into the field, we take what we can get, basically. And we eat a lot of pasta, a lot of rice, a lot of dried soups, a lot of peanuts, a lot of peanut butter if we can find it, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, that works. Tell me, before we go to calls, tell me about this experience in Egypt.
Well, you know, I was part of a travel group. I was the leader of the travel group, and we were in a mortuary temple near the Valley of the Kings, a big one. And a couple of my participants came up to me and said, you know, there's this shrine near the entrance to the temple, and we got this huge energy hit when we went in there. Now, I thought that was interesting, so I went back, because I didn't go in there. I went back to this shrine, which was some distance away, and went in there. And to make a long story short, I found myself in a very dim corridor. The walls were covered with hieroglyphics, and I could feel something. You know, you become sensitive to stuff like this when you do this a lot. And so I closed my eyes and I amped up. You know, I sort of amped up my personal power. And I cracked open an eye. And what I saw was an eyeball, a single living eyeball, looking at me from the wall of the corridor. And when I looked directly at it, it was gone. So I thought, there's something in here. But, you know, I was with a travel group at that point, so I didn't have a chance to really investigate it. But the next day, we were on our Nile cruise on the boat, and we were all in a big room, and I was drumming for the group, like we used the drum earlier on the show.
Yeah.
And I instructed people to go to a place, to go back to a place that we'd been to already, to reconnect with that place and connect with the spiritual guardians or the spirits that were living in that place to see what we could learn. So I went back to this shrine, and when I found myself, you know, I just remembered the shrine. I brought up the memory of the shrine in my mind while I'm drumming with my eyes closed. And I project my conscious awareness back into that shrine using the drum as liftoff. And this time there were two eyeballs. And since this didn't intimidate me, this smoky, vague form took shape in front of me. And it turned out that there is a genie, what we would call a genie, living in this shrine. And I had this very interesting conversation with the genie. First thing I did was to trick it into giving me its name, because once I knew its name, it couldn't lie to me. And, you know, I'm just giving it to you straight. You know, this is kind of like what I do. And so I asked the jinn if there was anything that it wanted. That was a very good beginning. And in the silence that followed, the image of the carved altar in this shrine came up in my mind's eye, and in response, the jinn's field, it sort of had an energetic field with pastels and greens and yellows and blues, kind of vaguely.
Sure. Given.
You know, the answer came almost shyly, honey. It wanted honey. Now, you know, I digested this request. I couldn't have come up with that in many years. And
it wanted honey?
It wanted honey. And so, you know, I was being watched by this spirit in the same way that a cat watches you just before you feed it, with that same intensity that cats have. And so what I did is I used my creative imagination to create a bowl of honey, a thought form. Okay, I'm in the dreaming of this place.
Right.
I'm in the dream world. I'm in the dream aspect of this shrine, and that's where the jinn is living. So I created a thought form of a bowl of honey. And as I put the honey on the altar, I said, I will give you this honey if you tell me your name. And any resistance in the jinn was gone. As it took the honey and drank gratefully, the jinn's name appeared in my mind. And then satisfied, the jinn turned its attention fully towards me. And, you know, we had this really interesting conversation. And the jinn opened by saying, you humans are creators. We, the jinn, cannot create anything, but we can mimic. We can imitate, and we can affect potential outcomes, but we cannot create. Then the jinn said, few can perceive us anymore, and fewer still can bind us to their will. Now that I have told you my name, you can ask me to serve you, and I will. Hey, it's beginning to sound like the Arabian Nights, isn't it?
It sure does.
Now, this isn't going on in Arabic or English. It's all going on in think feeling. It's all going on in nonverbal communication. So I asked the jinn what qualities and abilities it possessed, which might be of service to me. And the jinn kind of flickered thoughtfully and then answered, I can protect you from enemies, and I can inflict curses and misfortune on those who oppose you. My response was to say, I'm constrained in my practice from inflicting harm on anyone for any reason. You know, and still I thought to myself, this genie might come in handy if a really bad guy came along. You know, that sort of thing. So, how about healing work, I asked. The jinn replied by saying, who can say what's written on another person's soul? We cannot purposefully influence their destiny without tampering with their agreement. Agreement with who, I said. With the higher organizing intelligences. So I asked, are the jinn below them in the spiritual hierarchy? The jinn responded, oh yes. Some of the younger jinn occasionally misbehave, and the watchers approach them and encourage them in more appropriate forms of expression. This led me to ask, who are the watchers? The answer, the ones among the higher intelligences responsible for this world. We're not allowed to interfere with humans on their path, although there are some who do, as well as those who function as adversaries. I thought about this, and I thought about some of my recent reading. So I asked, are those the ones that the Gnostics called the Archons? Now, we're getting into this interesting stuff, George, which may hinge upon the UFOs and the ETs, okay? The jinn's response was, oh, so you know about them. The Archons are not true spirits. They're mind beings. They're mental entities, many of whom were created by humans as thought forms. Many of these function as attachments, as mental parasites. So I asked, how do they do that? The answer was, they feed on the energy, on the attention paid to them by humans. This includes the energy generated by human belief systems. But they're not true spirits, and they'll cease to exist if nobody pays attention to them anymore. The ones you call the Archons are those that we call the deceivers. And like us, they are not creative. They can mimic and they can take on forms in response to human belief systems. So I thought about this at some length, and then I asked, are they the ones we call the aliens or the extraterrestrials? The jinn didn't appear to understand the question, so I explained. Its response was more than interesting. This is what the jinn said. It said, the deceivers can take on many forms, drawing from the belief systems of humans, and there are also visitors who come here from other places. From other worlds, I asked? Yes. Who are they and why do they come here? They are others and they come here as visitors. Why do they abduct humans and perform experiments on them? They don't. It is the deceivers who do that.
Wow.
The deceivers? Why do they do that? Humans are greater than the deceivers. The deceivers that you have called the Archons wish to become more like humans, but they cannot create. They can only imitate, and the only power that they have is derived from humans. Humans have power, and the deceivers want that power. Why don't the Watchers, as you call them, inhibit the Archons, the deceivers, from interfering with humans? Here's the answer. The deceivers are not spirits. They live in the human mind, and so the Watchers cannot affect them. I considered this at some length, and then I asked some more questions. How long will you remain in this shrine? Again, the jinn didn't seem to understand the question, so I rephrased it. And the answer was, this is my place. Then I asked, if I travel here in my spirit form, in my dream body to this place, the way I've done right now, will I find you here? Yes. Why do you remain here instead of going someplace else? This is my place. Then I mentioned to this jinn that some years ago I met a jinnia, a female jinn, in the desert to the south of where this place was, and that she was of service to me in an interesting way, and I asked if he knew her. And he said, yes, all the jinn know each other. I asked, can you tell me her name? No. Can you convey my greetings to her as well as my respect? Yes, but you can do that yourself if you have connection with her. I've not felt the connection for many years, I said. Time is not in the spirit world. all time is now. Then I asked, do the jinn exist elsewhere in this world, beyond the deserts of Egypt and the Middle East? Yes. What are they called? I do not know, was the answer. We are the jinn, earthbound spirits. We live where we wish. Where do the jinn come from? The jinn are manifestations of the great spiritual force that the Gnostics called the Sophia. Everything that exists on this world exists as manifestations of the Sophia. Who or what is the Sophia, I asked. She is the soul of this world. Does she have a physical aspect, I asked. Yes, this world is her physical aspect. Where did the Sophia come from? She came from the center of, and then the jinn used a strange term to me. In asking for clarification, I was given to understand that the Sophia came from the core of our galaxy. Is the Sophia a goddess, I asked. I don't know, the jinn said. She emerged from, the strange term again, as a river of conscious light. She dreams, and all that she dreams comes into manifestation. That means that she is an, and here was an unrecognizable term.
Jeez, let's go to some of the calls, Hank.
Okay.
Fascinating. First-time caller, Pat in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, Pat.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
You're a great interviewer. I just love your show.
Thank you.
But, Hank, I have a question. I was an anthropology major in college.
Okay.
And I've been a psychic. I hate to use that word psychic, but I've been an intuitive healer since childhood. I'm Choctaw Indian descent, and my grandmother passed her information down to me and taught me as a child. And I traveled 4 years or more with the Native American healer in the States. We went to many different tribes. I've been doctored by different medicine people. And we did drumming ceremonies and healing ceremonies and really, you know, worked with quite a few people over the years. And my question is this, before 9/11, and I professionally, I guess you want to say professionally, do readings for people all the time. But before 9/11, I started receiving visions about all the terrorist activities that were going on. And I couldn't control it. It's the first time this information would come through, and ever it wanted to come through 24/7. I had like 150 predictions that came true and contacted Homeland Security. They came out, interviewed me, took my notes, and all this sort of stuff. And it was very frustrating because no one in the government will listen. And the information has started coming through again right before the Fort Hood incident. And so I emailed Russell Targ, and a friend of his is documenting and keeping all of my predictions on file for me. But you just made a comment that the Native American or the shaman said that we receive these visions so we can make changes.
That's right.
And my question is, I can't always control this information. It's very frustrating. It's not nice things that I'm seeing. And what can I do with this information? If we really can change the future and stop, that's my whole purpose in this. I don't even want people to know who I am. If I could work with someone in the government, but what can I do with this information? Because it's so accurate. And, for example, I saw the Christmas bomb. I was doing a reading for a client, and I saw a flight coming into the U.S. Christmas Day. There would be a terrorist attempt, just like the shoe bomber. And I even called the flight number, flight 253.
The Amsterdam to Detroit flight.
Yeah, right. And then I also saw the earthquake. I'm really tuned into earthquakes and volcanoes. I predicted, I don't know how many earthquakes, but I saw 7 to 8, which sounds preposterous. That's a huge earthquake. In the same reading, I said this, thousands of people, it was, you know, devastating. And so I just don't know what to do with this information. I've worked with medicine people. You know, this is not new to me at all, but I don't know what to do with this information.
Do you have a sense of where this information is coming from or who's giving it to you?
Well, you know, that's a good question. When I'm reading people, you're in their energy field, and I just use the higher chakras. I don't use anything lower, and I always work in the light. And this is, I don't know, it's very specific to these visions. It's very specific. It's the same exact energy every time.
Do you see the vision, or does the information just sort of come to you?
Both. I've seen, it's just like when I was doing the reading, I got the flight number, the whole, all that, you know, it can be very specific.
Right, I got that, yeah.
I can't explain it. I mean, that's the mystery to all of us about how this psychic phenomenon works. Somehow I've just tapped into this energy grid, I call it, and I didn't try to. It's not voluntary. It's just very frustrating. I'm trying to, if we can really make changes, I'll keep pushing to get someone to listen to me, but I don't know.
Well, let me just put in here that if you had grown up in a traditional society, your gifts would have been recognized when you were young, and probably you would have been trained from that time when you were a child, from a very early age,
sure,
to become a shaman, because you obviously have the ability. You obviously have the gift. You're one of those people, one of the 50% who are really good at it. And there are just jillions of you out there, and we don't live in a society in which this kind of information or this way of perceiving is highly valued. In fact, it's highly suspect. So what I would suggest, do you have a website?
Go ahead.
Bingo. I mean, you know, this is the kind of stuff that you can put out on the web. It can create a website where you can connect with an extraordinarily large number of people.
Or Twitter.
There's Twitter, but there's also, there are a lot of people that spend time reading in cyberspace, and there's some extraordinary information out there in the website. This transformational community that I've written about in the new book really exists like an overlapping set of networks that extend out across North America and into the international community. And I'm sure that if you start getting this information out there, you'll start to be drawn into connection with the people that you need to make contact with. That would be my suggestion, because the internet has provided us with an extraordinary tool for making connection with other people like ourselves.
It really does. Do you use it for anthropology as well, Hank?
Do I?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a question I really shouldn't answer, just in case somebody's listening in from the field. But let's just say that that I discovered in 1994, 95, when I went to the field, that I'm very good at finding things once again.
Yeah.
And the Africans noticed that, you know, when I got there, faces were very long. They'd been in the field for 6 weeks. Not much had been found. And the minute I got there, that's when we made the big discovery. Now, I would never claim anything. I would never claim that. But the fact is that it does happen. So I wouldn't ever say that I use my abilities to find things. But I am pretty good at finding things.
Now, do you have any more expeditions coming up?
I do. You know, I'm still a member of this. I'm an active member of this group. And anytime they need me to go into the field, they usually let me know and send me a plane ticket and a visa application and some malaria tablets.
And off you go.
And off I go.
Malaria tablets.
Well, yeah, there's malaria in this part of the world.
Can't you get a shot for that?
Nah, it doesn't really work.
I'm not a booster of vaccines anyway.
No, you got to take tablets. It's
I didn't know
dreadful
that.
Stuff, too.
I didn't know that. Okay, Hank, well, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll take final phone calls with you. I know a lot of you have been on hold for a long time, so we'll get to you as quickly as we can. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Absolutely. On our next Coast to Coast program, a very special show devoted to our space program. Will we go back to the moon? Will we go to Mars? What is NASA up to? Richard C. Hoagland's been working on it for a few weeks. He's putting it together for us, and he'll be our main guest on Coast to Coast. This should be exciting, Richard C.
Yeah, I'm wearing my producer hat again.
Yes, you are. And it's a good hat indeed.
Last time was NBC. This time it's Coast again.
Well, you got some good surprises for us.
I really do. We're going to try to decode Obama's space program. There's a tremendous amount of controversy in the Congress. Republicans and Democrats, for the first time in this administration, are united against Obama's proposals, which is really interesting because there's more than meets the eye. And tomorrow night, or tonight, actually, we're going to have a parade of very interesting folks, some from NASA headquarters, some from the civilian community, maybe even an astronaut, to talk about what's really going on.
Stay tuned with Richard C. Hoagland tomorrow, our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com on our next Coast to Coast show. And welcome back to Coast, Hank Wesselman, our special guest, Awakening to the Spirit World, your calls. Hank, is the book out there? Can people get it now?
It sure is. And I might add, you know, that for those who go to our website, we have a big mailing list. And if people sign up for our mailing list on our website, they can download free chapters from the book to get a look at it. But it's out there everywhere, and it's selling very briskly. I think it was number 800 or something on Amazon a couple of days ago, on number one in shamanism, number one in paganism, number one in theology. You know,
number one in paganism?
paganism.
All right, to the calls we go. West of the Rockies, Isaac in Eureka, California. Hey, Isaac, thanks for holding.
Hey, two quick questions.
Sure.
I know many shamans around the world use plants that aid in visions, and I recently read a book called The Spirit Molecule, and in it, it talks about a gland in your brain called the pineal gland.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if Hank has used any of these, such as like the Ayahuasca of Peru or the Ibogaine, I believe, of Africa.
Fair question. And, Hank, have you?
I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you, Isaac. Go ahead, Hank.
You wrote the book on DMT, the spirit molecule?
He might have.
He might have. Well, to answer your question, in 2008, I was invited to the Wasiwaska Institute in Brazil by a very famous Brazilian anthropologist who's actually, he's actually a Colombian named Luis Eduardo Luna. And while I was there for 2 weeks teaching, we did 5 ayahuasca ceremonies during that time. And I found them very interesting, but, you know, they came on the heels of a practice. I've been practicing shamanism for probably 28, 29 years now. And my discovery was that I can go much faster and much further using the drum, using my own shamanic method, than I can go with the ayahuasca. There was a Hungarian psychiatrist there named Edi Frekska, who was very well published. And he hypothesized that I have a very active DMT uptake mechanism in my brain, and that this is part of what enables me to have these visions. Because the way in which I described my visions in the Spirit Walker trilogy, you know, he said it's obvious that the parallels between what you're experiencing and the DMT experience are very, very obvious. So this may be part of what makes it work, and those of us who can shamanize. But, you know, it's an ability which all people have to a greater or less extent, and the DMT is something that we manufacture in the pineal gland ourselves. So when you get an overload of this stuff, wham, off you go.
Okay, let's go to Wichita Falls, Texas, east of the Rockies. Roger, it's your turn.
Hey, George. Hey, Hank. How are you all tonight?
Good.
Hey, great. I'm part Osage, and everything that you're saying is absolutely on cue. I use drumming as a method to go places where I'd like to go and to contact ancestors to make things happen creatively, et cetera. I wish when I was younger I had known someone who could have explained the difference between, you mentioned paganism, one of my favorite words, drawing the powers of the spirits or of the elementals, the difference between that, let's say, and journeying or going on a shamanistic journey. I was told early on that I would have to have the ability to travel shamanistically to complete magical rite. And that has proven to be false because all one needs is faith, but absolutely to create or to go on shamanistic journeys, it's necessary to have that dreamlike inner eye, and to go to those places, visualization is a must. Could you clarify the difference as you see it between magic and shamanism?
Well, this is a very interesting question. The shaman is the magician. There's a lot of confusion in the Western world between what magic is and what magic isn't. True magic is being able to step into the realm of the sacred, into the hidden world, connect with the energies that are available to us there, and then bring those energies back into this world to manifest something. Like healing, for example, that's magic. Standing up and stay on stage in Vegas and doing these incredible, you know, tricks, those are illusions. That's not magic.
Okay, good. Thank you. Next up, we go to Cincinnati now. Jen's with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Jen.
Yes, hello, and thank you both for sharing your wisdom and knowledge. I wanted to ask the guest, have you ever experienced or heard of a visitation by a diamond white sparkling being with little orbs of blue around it?
Yes, I have. This, you know, one of the things that I do in the workshops that we guide people into this experience in, as I try to guide them to the light beyond the form and the formless beyond the light, because I don't perceive these higher organizing intelligences or these spiritual beings necessarily as a physical form. I perceive them as light, and usually that light has a voice and a presence. It's a visible light, like a milky white sparkling light. Is that what you're describing?
Yes, it is. And I tried to ask the questions out loud, actually. I am very spiritual and I meditate. And I got nothing back. And I just turned right at it and looked right at it. And because it was with me for like 5 minutes. And I shut my eyes and it was, you know, with my other vision that I was seeing it. I was seeing it with my eyes open. And then I would shut my eyes and I would still see it, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense.
And I asked it, you know, are you of the light? Nothing. If you are, may I send you a gift of light? Nothing. Finally, I just looked right at it and I said out loud, I see you. And boop, it disappears.
Uh-huh. Well, it was a presence. And, you know, these are gifts. They reveal to us that we're not alone.
Skype line Justin in Colorado Springs, Colorado. You're on with Hank Wesselman. Go ahead, Justin.
Yes, hi, George. Great to talk to you.
Hi.
From the middle of the Rockies.
There you are.
Yep.
Yes. My question for your guest is, great topic tonight. I was wondering, is there any connection between shamanism and Christianity, Gnostic Christianity, maybe even a part of the ancient Jewish cultures?
Yes, there is. In fact, you could call Jesus a great shaman for the things that he was able to do. You remember how he brought Lazarus back from the dead? That's a classic example of soul retrieval.
Sure, absolutely. What about being able to, you know, make mounds of food and, you know, jugs of wine and things like that?
That's magic, you know, and people can do that. You know, the African shamans can turn water into wine and wine into water. I mean, this is very well known. This has been observed.
Absolutely.
It's shamanism in every sense.
Justin, thank you. On the Skype line, now we go to Matthew in Madison, Wisconsin. It's your turn, Matthew. Go ahead.
Hello. How are you guys doing tonight?
Okay, all is well.
The Dalai Lama is going to be coming to Madison in May. I thought that was quite interesting.
Super.
But I got into a car accident September 29th of 2001. And since then, I've had tremendous problems with memory loss.
Uh-huh.
And I was watching Bio. And they have a show called Celebrity Ghost Stories. And I was watching, and they had two different pills that he was talking about that would help for memory. It's called Astovital.
Uh-huh.
And Giver Vital.
Uh-huh. Well, let me throw something in here. Memory loss or blocked memory is a classic example of soul loss. It's a classic symptom of soul loss.
Yeah, something's causing it.
And you might go to Sandra Engerman's website, because she has a website called shamanicteachers.com, and it will bring you into connection with a list of practitioners who she's trained. And I'll bet you're able to find somebody in your area who you could work with person to person and see if this ancient methodology would help you.
At the outset of our interview, Hank, our discussion, you talked about how you felt this belief in shamanism, belief in meditation, this push toward more spirituality was growing. Why now? What's going on?
Well, we're coming to the end of a cycle, and everything is winding down. It's like we're coming into the point of the spiral. And as we do, the great unraveling is happening. We're at a point where at the end of this cycle and the beginning of the next, if history repeats itself, a new kind of religion is going to come into being. This is something I wrote about in that chapter on the transformational community in Awakening to the Spirit World. I wrote about the fact that there are these four cycles of ages, and in each cycle, at the end of each cycle and the beginning of the next, a new kind of religion appeared. You know, the first...
That, you can track that. That's happening.
It's happening right now. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that Christianity is wrong, although a lot of Christians are inclined to think that, because if you're right, then I must be wrong. It's that we're taking it to a new level. It's expanding. And it's no longer about scripture. It's now about each person having direct connection with these transpersonal worlds themselves to become their own priest, their own prophet, their own guru, their own teacher, receiving their revelations themselves from the highest sources.
Let's go to Dean, who's in your neck of the woods in Hawaii. Go ahead, Dean.
Hey, folks. How you doing?
Good.
I had a quick question for Hank, but before I wanted to say hi, I don't know if you remember, Hank, I was in the three-year...
You were in the three-year program.
There you go.
I was your partner in the group.
I remember. How are you? How's your health?
I'm doing good, and you sound like you're doing some great work, and I'm loving these interviews.
Good. What's your question, Dean?
I had a quick question for you. I don't know if you're familiar with Michael Cremo's work. He was on a couple days ago. He does some cryptoanthropology.
Yep.
Cryptoanthropology.
Well, he does forbidden archaeology. He believes in human devolution. His belief system, Hank, way older than Artie, he believes that mankind might be hundreds of millions of years old.
Well, you know, somebody stuck his book under my nose several years ago, and I spent several hours scanning it. And I found it a fascinating book that would contain a great deal of information. But in that information, there's also a lot of misinformation. You know, being a scientist, I want to see the evidence, like those little spheroids with grooves in them.
Yeah, well, that's what we talked about.
Well, the key is the geology. I mean, you can claim that they're 200 million years old. I want to see the geology because that's where the key is.
And well, there are no guarantees
that it came from such.
No, all he knew was that it was in 200 million years old of geology, but they couldn't prove how old the actual metal round balls were.
Yeah, they could be concretions, you know, that take form around the edges of desiccating lake margins. And I've seen stuff like that in Africa. You need to see each case and study them to determine.
I should get you two together, though. What a great show that would be.
The veracity, you know?
My God. Go ahead, Dean. Follow up.
You pretty much answered my question. I was curious whether you had either shamanic experiences to back up his research or anthropological, and it doesn't sound like you've had either, that Homo sapiens have been around for perhaps even millions of years.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have any evidence that Homo sapiens is earlier than about 200,000 years old. I mean, I've seen the evidence. I've handled the bones. I've been in the field. I've been to the sites. And I can state with affirmation that Homo sapiens sort of kicks in around 200,000 years ago.
Have we ever stumbled across an ancient cemetery? You know, like where Artie, you said there have been 36 of them found. But it wasn't like in a cemetery setting, was it?
People did not begin to bury their dead until about 70, 80,000 years ago.
Huh.
And the first people who began to bury their dead were your friends, the Neanderthals.
Yep.
And, you know, once they did, of course.
My dear friends, I go out with them on weekends.
Because we can find grave goods. We can find skeletons buried with bones, probably had meat on them. So the Neanderthals had a sense of the afterlife. And the food was for the journey into the afterlife. And often their bodies were covered with flowers because we can find the sediments around the skeleton packed with pollen. And they poured red ochre on the body for ritual purposes, probably. And the ground around the skeleton is stained red with this red ochre. That kicks in around 80, 90,000 years ago.
What did they do to bodies from previously before that? They just, as you said, and some of them were cannibals.
Well, they just abandoned them by the side of the road. You know, there's a cave in northern France, in southern France, northern Spain, and there people were living in caves there as early as 300,000-400,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and they were dumping their dead down the shafts in the caves.
Oh.
And so today we can excavate those shafts. I mean, you got to go straight down with climbing tackle and all sorts of things.
Bones everywhere.
But they've got bones everywhere. Bones everywhere. And these are the precursors of the Neanderthal people.
Let's go to Columbia, Missouri and get a quick question out of you. Greg, go ahead.
Hi, I had a question if you're familiar with the work of Terrence McKenna, and I also had a comment.
I knew Terrence McKenna.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. So you know his work.
About his, the idea about the mushroom, psilocybin mushroom, being the catalyst for the evolution that took place.
Well, it's a very compelling argument, and Terrence was a brilliant guy. You know, his loss was a loss for all of us. I mean, he was one of the charter members of the Psychedelic Explorers Club. It's something we've written about in Awakening to the Spirit World, and I actually mentioned, Terrence, that there are many people who feel that the discovery of hallucinogenic plants, psychotropic plants, may have been the genesis for all religion everywhere. It may have actually facilitated human evolution. It's a very compelling idea. It's something I think about sometimes in the middle of the night.
Where do your journeys take you next, Tank?
Again?
Where do your journeys take you next?
Where do they take me next? Well, I'm traveling to California in about 2 weeks. I'll be teaching in California and in Oregon and at the Esalen Institute in April. I'll be on the road for about a month, and then I'll be home. My schedule can be seen on my website, sharedwisdom.com, for those who are interested in this kind of stuff, because I train people to do it. Then in May, I will be back in California for an advanced program. In June, I'll be at Esalen again, and in New York at the Omega Institute, and so forth, around the clock.
Very good. Hank, thanks for being on the program. Good luck with this latest work, Awakening to the Spirit World.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Hank Wesselman, he's an anthropologist. You know, he's a real scientist, but he's been doing a lot of work into the shamanic experience, and it has taken him down a path he probably never thought he would go. Awakening to the Spirit World. Drumbeat was pretty cool, too, I think, wasn't it? Don't forget, Richard C. Hoagland and the cast of how many he's putting together for the program on NASA on our next Coast to Coast show. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.